if you'd have gone back several decades and asked Haridim, what excuse do you have for exempting yourself from army service, learning Torah? They'll say, what do you mean? Learning Torah is the most important thing in the world. There's nothing more important than doing that. And therefore, the rest of the world can go jump in a lake. I don't care if the Zionists are in charge here or if the Arabs are in charge here. Or I don't care if we're under British occupation. Who cares? I want to sit in my yeshiva and learn. And whoever the political power is, the politics be damned, essentially. Whereas now, a much more common claim made by Haridim is, we are contributing to the state. We are the front lines of the state. It's because of us that Israel is succeeding, which in a funny way, it's them arguing that they are doing their bit for the state of Israel. They are soldiers. They are crack frontline troops.
תורה מגנה מצא, אתם צריכים את הצבא. אם לא יהיה חטאים פה, לא יהיה מלחמות. התורה שלנו עכשיו מגנה על אחרים.
זאת אומרת, אם כל החיילים מאז היוצאים עכשיו, הולכים לישיבה ללמוד, חמאס מחוסלים אוטומטית.
חד משמעי, אין, זה עובדה. אנחנו כבר במשך שנים בסדיר, מגנים כל דקה על חייל נוסף שלא ימות. אף פעם לא נתגייס ונעדיף ללכת לכל.
It is the case that people cease being religious in Tzahal. But why is this the case? Because being in Tzahal for many people is the first time they don't have anyone breathing down their neck for religious reasons. Nobody cares what you do on Shabbat. Nobody cares what you do late at night. And that is the point that breaks a lot of people whose religious convictions isn't strong enough to withstand the temptation of lack of oversight. The Haridim say, if our boys go to Tzahal, they'll all immediately become Chiloni. This is such a sad indictment of the Haredi educational system.
This is Listening to Understand, where sensitive Jewish truth seekers gather in a safe place for candid conversations on challenging topics. When we listen to truly understand, and not in order to respond, we can replace judgment with curiosity and open our hearts to every Jew, regardless of their personal choices. As Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. I'm Atana. Let's get started. One of the reasons we started Listening to Understand was to have a safe place for difficult conversations, to bridge the gap, to unite us a little bit more, to give more tolerance for other perspectives, other beliefs, to remind us that we're one nation and we matter together and we're important together and we need to be united and we need to act as one. But so often, our point of views, our religious perspectives, our ideology gets in the way. And we forget that there's really another Jew and we really need to accept them for their beliefs. Now, what do we do when it's something very difficult, that it's hard to coexist when our beliefs are so different? One of the things that we saw after October 7th, that Jews were uniting from all over the world in order to support each other, to be united, to pray, to defeat Hamas and to keep Israel safe and to help those that had to leave their communities, help those that lost loved ones. It was one mission. Am Israel Chai. We're going to conquer. Biyachad Nenatzach. Together we will win. And there's a little bit of going back to the pains that were before October 7th. A lot of people around the world were hoping that this atrocity that happened in Israel will unite us. There's still a big gap between beliefs that is causing friction. Today, we're going to speak about who should be serving in the IDF. Should Haredi people be exempt? Should they be serving in the army? How was it designed originally, Bekuma Medina? Maybe the system was built on a preconceived notion from a long time ago, and the system needs to evolve. J.J. Kimchi grew up in the Haredi community in London, and he went to the IDF, and he wants to give his perspective on why he thinks Haredi believe that they should not go to the army. Should they really be exempt? Should they not? There was this video going around. It was heart-wrenching to watch this video. If you want to watch the video, go to our link in the show notes, the Listening to Understand WhatsApp group. We will share the video there. The Israeli news, Arutz 12, interviewing yeshiva boys. I don't think that they represent the Haredi community, but it's a voice that went around and it was a painful voice to hear, especially for people that serve in the IDF. I want to hear both perspectives. There is a tremendous amount of pain on both sides being misunderstood or not validated or feeling unjust, unfair, and it's creating a friction. And these frictions is what tears us apart, and we need to understand the why. The truth is, we need to be together. Ki rak beyachad, with achdut, nenatzach. We have a better chance to win because of the achdut. We need to really take that seriously and not use it only as a slogan. And hopefully we can bridge the gap and bring some compassion and understanding to both sides. please give us a rating and review. Either you're on Spotify or iTunes, share this episode. Share, share, share. Let's ignite more conversations. Love to hear your feedback. Enjoy this episode.
J.J. Kimche is a PhD candidate at Harvard University, where he specializes in European and Jewish intellectual history of the modern era. He received his undergraduate education at Shalom College, Jerusalem, where he double majored in Western philosophy and Jewish thought. Prior to that, he studied at Yeshivat Har Etzion and completed his military service in the 101st Division of the IDF's Paratroopers Brigade. He has given courses on Western and Jewish ideas at Harvard, Brandeis, MIT, Gratz College, and other institutions. His writings and articles have been published in the Wall Street Journal, First Things, City Journal, and other publications. He is the editor of his first academic book, Letters on Kabbalah, which is soon due to be published. He's the host of, and may be found conversing with other scholars on, the podcast of Jewish Ideas. And now your host, Matana.
Thank you for joining me here, JJ.
Firstly, Matana, can I say it's a pleasure to be here and congratulate you on this podcast. It's rare to find people, and even more rare to find Jews, who are willing to listen literally to understand instead of simply to interject and posit their own opinion. So I'm glad to be and glad to talk about this. I'm afraid I share your skepticism for the time being in terms of people saying there is such unity in Israel. The truth is there is at the moment unity in Israel to a large degree, even though we're starting to see that crack where we are recording this in the middle of March. And we've already started to see some return of some of the anti-government protesters. We've already started to see some of the more hardline attitudes crop up once again in the Haredi community against serving in Tzahal and other such things. And therefore, there is a sense of unity, as there always is when there is an external threat. But as the war is dragging on longer and longer, so there is a sort of resettling and a renormalization among, as it seems to me, traditional party lines to a certain degree. Again, we will have to see where this is going. So you asked me a little bit about the history of Haredim and Zionism and where they stand today in the historical context. Obviously, this is a very lengthy and quite complex issue. I will give you just a few sort of, I would say, major historical markers and explain a little bit of the background for those who don't know so much why Haredim refuse, what is the nature of their refusal, and how many, in fact, do serve or don't serve. And I think the best way to go about this is to go travel back in time a little bit to the 19th century, which is where I spend most of my time. I'm a student of intellectual history, specifically in the 19th century. So that's where I spent quite a bit of my time. And the 19th century was, of course, the age of great nationalisms, not just among the Jewish people, but around the world in Central Europe. There were many small national groups which were subsumed in much larger empires. And these national groups started to agitate, started to politically campaign for their own independence. And after World War I, many of them did, in fact, gain independence with the crumbling of large parts of the Russian Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the German Reich and other such things. Within this context, there was a rise in what might be called Jewish nationalism, better known as Zionism. Now, the difference a little bit between Zionism and many other nationalisms is that Zionism could and did make a very strong claim to be authentically Jewish in the most ancient sense possible, right? In other words, that Zionists, both religious and irreligious, and we'll get there in a moment, could point to ancient Jewish history and say, listen, we were once an independent people in an independent land. True, we had a different sense of who the Jews were and what the Jews were supposed to do. True that the Jews back then, let's say, at least paid much more lip service to the covenant, to the biblical covenant, and possibly saw themselves as keeping it, whereas today, in 19th century European Jewry, many of them did not. Many of them had by then abandoned or largely abandoned the religion of their ancestors. But nonetheless, Zionism had this rocket fuel, as it were, of what they saw as authenticity, what they saw as ancient Jewish a polity, really, that existed for 1,000 years, in which you had kings and you had armies and you had generals and you had international relations and you had an economy and you had the full cultural thriving of a people, including, of course, the composition of the Hebrew Bible, of the Tanakh. So what we have here is the Zionist movement sought to reconstitute that Jewish national entity in the land of Israel. However, there were two issues with this. Number one is that, of course, most of the Zionist movement were, in fact, not only non-religious, they were anti-religious, right? A lot of the Zionist leaders, including, of course, most famously Theodor Herzl himself, they were proposing and they were politically organizing and campaigning for a return of Jews to the land of Israel. Not all of them were so clear on what they wanted, whether they wanted a state or a protectorate under the British Empire or something else. But basically, they wanted a situation in which the Jews would return en masse to the land. But the problem is, they wanted to do it within the context of these secular nationalisms. They weren't looking to reconstitute the Jewish people under the banner of the Jewish religion. In fact, for them, that was an anathema. They didn't want that at all. And so therefore, the Zionist movement, and in fact, the Zionist movement became deeply intertwined with forms of socialism, even communism, certainly religious ideologies or even atheism. And therefore, it was seen correctly in many ways as a competing ideological force against traditional Judaism. In other words, many Orthodox rabbis looked at the Zionist movement and said, this movement is It is laying claim to the loyalty of our young people, laying claim to the loyalty of the Jewish people to reconstitute the homeland and the culture and the economy and basically a thriving life of a full nation. But the truth is that we actually have a different set of loyalties, namely loyalty to the Torah, loyalty to mitzvot, etc., etc. In other words, in the Orthodox perspective, the key and primary loyalty of the Jews always had to be to their religion, right? And not to some kind of envisioned nation resurrected from an ancient past in a new guise in the 20th century. That for them stood in stark contrast to what they thought. And of course, if I was being a bit more cynical, and if you want a more political look at it, you'll say that it constituted a direct competition to rabbinic power. In other words, both the Maskilim in the early 19th century and the Zionists in the late 19th century constituted another source of authority, another sort of ideological power base, which attracted young Jews in their hundreds of thousands, and therefore was seen by the rabbinate, again, as this kind of mortal threat to the religious way of life. So under these, I would say, very regrettable circumstances, there arose in the mind of many Orthodox rabbinic authorities a fundamental opposition between the Zionist movement, between the aims and aspirations of a Zionist state to found a secular Jewish state in the land of Israel, and Orthodox religion and traditional Jewish religion. So that is, I think, the main basis, is that due to historical circumstances. Now, let me posit here at the beginning that it didn't have to be this way. In other words, you could have had a scenario in which large parts of the Jewish, of the religious Jewish world, of the Orthodox world, at the time would have embraced Zionism, would have seen this as something desirable, as the reconstitution of the Jewish people and the Jewish land, and tried to, as they do today, try to form part of the committees that ran the Zionist movement and try to influence it from within and try to form, sort of mold the Jewish state in their own image. This could have happened, but largely it didn't. And there were some exceptions, of course, famously Rav Kook and other religious Zionists, right, early religious Zionist rabbis, but for the most part, European Orthodoxy rejected Zionism. And therefore, you have, I think, at basis, at root, already for close to 200 years now, a fundamental opposition, ideologically, that grew up, unnecessarily, in my opinion, between the Orthodox Judaism and Zionism. That's the first tachana, the first point that must be borne in mind for why there is this general Haredi suspicion of the state. Of
course, this has changed. Original split in the ideology.
Yes, yes, very important original split. Yes, exactly. Now, it is also important to bear in mind, during the early years of the 20th century and the state of Israel, just how secular the state was. Now, we are quite used to nowadays going to Israel, firstly, seeing lots and lots of religious people everywhere, right? We see hundreds of thousands of Haredim and Dati Lumim and other people, Sfaradim. Right. We're used to seeing religious people everywhere. We're also quite used to, in Israel, the presence of a very large group, what you call Mesoratim, generally, which are people who are not outwardly looking religious. Traditionalist. And what that means is they don't keep halakha as is generally understood by most other Jews. But what they do is they observe a form of Shabbat and they observe a form of Kashrut and the Chagim, etc., etc. This was very much not the case in the early and mid-20th century Israel. It was a very secular Jewish place. And the Haredi element, which there always was, because those living in Yerushalayim and other places from way before.
The Yerushalmim,
exactly, what they call the Yeshuv HaYashan, were avowedly, of course, avowedly Orthodox. And they felt, they understood themselves to be conceived of themselves as an embattled minority, right? They are surrounded by a sea of people who don't share their values in the slightest, don't see any worth whatsoever, really, in any kind of religiosity. Many of them, in fact, many elements of the kibbutz system, openly and vehemently anti-religious. And therefore, they saw themselves as an embattled minority whose job it is, with any embattled minority, to preserve their way of life. The number one priority in living in the state of Israel, both pre- and post-state, was to preserve their way of life, which led to the initial arrangement, which has been much mythologized and romanticized in the early years of the state, between the Israeli government, headed by Ben-Gurion, and the Haredi
leader,
sector
Chazon
population, headed by the Chazon Ish, by Yishai Karelitz, who was the senior Orthodox rabbi at the time. And essentially, because the Haredim were so
small. One second, let me ask you, I have a few questions. Was he living in Israel at the time?
Who? Chazon Ish?
Israel?
Yeah.
So let me just ask you about the Yerushalmim and the people, the very Orthodox people that were living there. They were living there for many years before Ben-Gurion said, let's
want to communicate. For generations prior to the advent of the Aliyah.
In a way, I'm going to give a little bit of a radical example, but like the Indian saying, like, we were here first in America.
In a way, yes. Look, the problem is that this is the case with all Jews everywhere, because the invention or the rise of mass Jewish secularism is a very modern phenomenon, right? It really only happened during the middle decades of the 19th century. Something I studied quite a lot, which is that really until the early to mid-19th century, to be Jewish meant to be in some form or other Shomer Torah or Mitzvah, the Shomer Halacha.
Right.
And only starting in the Germanic lands in Europe, but quickly sweeping throughout much of Europe and certainly capturing the Russian Empire, which is where most Jews in the world lived in the late 19th century, and then all those immigrants who went to America and continued this in the late 19th century. So yes, so the whole idea that you have an embattled Orthodox minority fighting against a much larger majority, this is true across the Jewish world everywhere, right? You could say that a religious Jew living in Warsaw at the time, or living in living in Paris or Berlin, yes, in the middle of the 19th century, could turn around and say, hang on a second, a generation ago, people like me with the universal norm, almost universal norm, let's say, apart from a very tiny cultural elite, and suddenly I'm an embattled minority. This is the fundamental position of Shimshon Shofar Hirsch, right? In Frankfurt with his shul and elsewhere, he's essentially the German rabbi looked around, and suddenly they were very distinctly the minority. It's a very difficult, discombobulating feeling. Having said that, look, there always has been, it's one of the great myths of the anti-Zionist accusers against the Jewish people against the state of Israel. The Jews vacated the land between the year 70 CE when the Second Temple was destroyed and the early Zionist movement in the late 19th century. The Jews suddenly vacated the land. This is not true at all. Firstly, there was a constant Jewish presence always. And secondly, there were throughout history various waves of Aliyah, often responding to disasters. After the Gerush Sfarad, there were waves of Aliyah.
Right.
In the time coming to Hagra, and at various times in Jewish history, there were waves of Aliyah. But yes, so back to the point of history.
I just wanted to understand. Okay, fine.
Second major stage that I want to point out is again the stage where there was this agreement between the small, beleaguered, embattled, dwindling Haredi minority in the land of Israel immediately after the creation of the state. And the state was already basically said that we can grant exemptions to, I think was the time, 400 yeshiva students, and that they wouldn't have to serve because they could claim that learning in yeshiva was their livelihood, was what they were doing, and therefore they could gain exemptions in that way. Now, there's another interesting facet to this, which is, I think, a little bit understudied and underrepresented, which is that in the 1940s, 50s, or 60s, and 60s or so, it was the general consensus in the West that religion, that I would say Orthodox religion, very stringent religion, everywhere was dying, right? And you could find, I think there was a famous front cover of Time magazine in the 1960s saying, is God dead? And essentially, the confident prediction of the anthropologists at the time was that within half a century, there would be almost no Orthodox religion really of any kind, whether Christian or Jewish or anywhere in the West. All would succumb to this kind of generalized melting pot. You'd have a few little outposts of fundamentalists, but essentially fundamentalist religion is going to dwindle and disappear. And this seemed to be the opinion also of many of the Israeli leadership in the early years of the state. In other words, okay, yes, we have a religious minority, but they're never going to cause us a big problem. They will either disappear or they'll remain a small little outpost. We can live with one Meir Sha'arim, one B'nai
Brak. Why did they think that? But why? Was it a post-Holocaust? Like they thought it was like a post-Holocaust reaction?
No, it's not, nothing to do with the Holocaust. The Holocaust obviously plays a big part in all of this, but I'm talking about a general phenomenon throughout the West. There was this absolute, similar to the idea of the end of history that cropped up in the 1990s, this was a kind of end of religious history that, okay, we've reached a point where the vast majority of people in the West are either irreligious entirely or belong to some kind of relatively secularized form of religion, a kind of Anglican church, let's say, where, okay, you're a secular private citizen, but go to church on a Sunday kind of religion. And they confidently expected that this was the way that the trends were going. And within a few decades, that would be almost everyone. And therefore, there was little need to worry, at least in Western countries and Western societies, from a resurgence of religious fundamentalism. Of course, they were badly wrong, not just in Israel, but everywhere else, right? Religion has, in many ways, Europe, in some states of Europe, is a little bit of an exception. But religion, certainly in the United States, and certainly in Israel and other places, has experienced an extraordinary renaissance. And therefore, this has caused all sorts of issues. And one of them is, within the states of Israel, suddenly, an exemption that was meant for a few hundred students at best is now applied to thousands of students every year, tens of thousands even. And the problem is, it's a problem from the perspective of the state, is that the more the Haredi community continues to grow, and the more that they continue to refuse to serve in the army. So that is a progressively greater and greater proportion of the population. I don't know the precise statistics, but I think a few years ago, it was the case that one third of all Jewish kids in Kitta Aleph and in first grade in Israel were from the Haredi community. I don't know what the precise things are, but basically,
because they have more children than
they have many more children,
many and more, and it's almost every year or every other year.
Correct. And also the attrition rate is not nearly as much as was originally thought. In other words, the original idea was, okay, Harim will continue to have children, but hey, a vast portion of them will do the sensible thing and abandon their religious fundamentalism. And the truth is that hasn't happened. Now that is happening in greater numbers today. Again, there's an argument exactly among statistics. Very hard to do very precise statistics in the Haredi community. They don't really answer polls that much. They don't really answer questions.
Are they leaving Haredi or they're leaving religion?
Leaving religion, mostly. I'm saying the statistic I heard recently is 1 in 10 Haredi young men do leave the Haredi community or do become irreligious. I'm dubious of that statistic. I don't know the extent to which is true. Mm-hmm. And that it's a bit more than 1 in 5 in the religious Zionist community, which suffers worse from attrition rates like that. So basically, the point is that the second tachana is important to note is that the Haredi managed to receive an exemption from the government in the early years of the state, which nobody in the government imagined would one day create a serious split in the nation. And at a certain point in the not too distant future, also a problem for national security. Because at the end of the day, Israel does need a large standing army. It needs a very large force of men in arms in order to secure the various borders and in order to patrol Yehuda and Shomron and the various other things. The second point.
Can I ask you a point on that?
Yeah, please do.
Because I'm going to forget. I'm just curious. So Ben-Gurion met with the Chazon Ish and they said, okay, fine, 400, 600, whatever. And I don't know if it was only Toratam Umanutam. I think it was the Chazon Ish saying, okay, it's a Medina Yehudit. We need both fronts. We need the Chazit and we need the spiritual. We want Medina Yehudit. You get what you want. We get what we want.
This meeting has been greatly, as I said, romanticized, and many different versions of how the conversation went.
So the theory, it doesn't matter the theory.
Yeah. It's much more important how it was told than what actually happened. With many of us, especially in the way to really know so well what's happened, we definitely know how it was told. And that's what is influential in later history. But yes.
But could it be that the Chazon Ish really had a very good point of saying, the Medina Yehudit, we need to keep the Torah here. So I'll give you the Tava, you give me the Torah, and we'll take care of the spirituality and make sure that it stays in this Medina Yehudit, and keep our borders safe. My question to you is, let's say it was like that. Let's say it was romanticized like that, as you say. I love the word, bro. You made it. I don't know what Ben-Gurion thought. Probably people that studied him probably know much more than me, but it's irrelevant. My question is, let's say they came to an agreement. Even if they were complete disagreement, they came to an agreement. My question is, why 20 years into it, when they saw that it was multiplying and it was much more than 600 or whatever was accounted, let's say, four times more or whatever, and every year just multiplying, why didn't they put a cap and say, listen, fine, Haredim, you want Toratam Umanutam, you want to keep the tradition in Israel, it's important, the Medina Yehudit, let's cap it, let's take the tops, just like back in Slobodka, like that, who sat and learned? Only the great ones, right?
Okay, the answer to this lies a little bit in the history of Israeli politics and also the rise of the Haredim as a political force in Israel. Until 1977, the left, Labour, the Mapai party, the sort of socialist left Zionist parties, had a firm lock on the levers of power in the state of Israel. They constituted the government, they constituted the very powerful unions, they constituted all the heads of industry and the heads of the army, and basically they ran the country. This was gradually weakening in the 70s until 1977, the election of Menachem Begin, the Mapai, the revolution, and famously Begin and his right-wing parties sweep into power and upend this cozy arrangement. And since 1977, what you have is like you have in most functioning and normal democracies, is an exchange of power every however many number of years, right? So every 2 years you'd have some a left-wing government, some right-wing government, to go back and forth and back and forth. Okay. What that meant was a parliamentary democracy with proportional representation like the state of Israel. What that means is that small parties can actually make a big difference. Because if you're trying to build a coalition of 61 seats, as you need in the Knesset is 120 seats, you need 61 seats, i.e. a majority of the Knesset, in order to form a functioning government. So what that means is that small political parties can be very powerful. They can be the kingmakers. Right. They can be the ones who decide now.
The breaking forces.
What happens in the 1980s, the Haredim, actually the first to really make, I would say, an industry or make a concerted attempt at this, was actually the Sfaradim, under the leadership of Rav Ovadia Yosef and the Shas party, exactly, was to realize, one second, we have actually growing numbers in our party. And while we won't constitute the major seats of government, and still don't, the Haredim have never achieved a large enough number that they can actually constitute the government themselves, although maybe that day is not so far off. However, what they did manage to start achieving was large enough groups in the Knesset that they could sway the outcome of an election. In other words, if I'm just making up statistics here, but let's say 40% of the vote went to the left and 40% of the vote went to the right and 20% goes to the Haredim, let's say in the middle, so then they decide who's in power. And of course, they want to join the government, but they exact a high price. And this is something that has led to an enormous amount of resentment in Israel against the Haredim. Because the Haredim vote en masse, they organize very effectively politically. They organize very en masse and very in a very unified and very disciplined and uniform way. And what they do is they get their own people elected to power, and then they go to those who want to form the government. They go to people, whoever wants to form a government, and say, listen, we will join the government and we will allow you to enact your agenda, which you think is very important about national security, about the economy, whatever. And the price that you have to pay is to continue giving us these exemptions and to give us money for our schools and to give us a laundry list of other things. And basically, because each successive Israeli government has had more on its mind, has had greater priorities than the Haredim and the Gius.
They said, we need you. We'll give you what you want. Just come join us.
Take what you want.
So it was a price to pay. So they're like, we're willing to pay this price in order to gain the...
And the Haredim have been extremely good at doing it.
Good for them. And I say, kol hakavod.
On the one hand, there's two ways of looking at this. On the one hand, we say, kol hakavod, listen, you're acting as a group. You're acting, you are, and
you're
many
voice.
Other, you have voices, and there are many other minorities in various countries that do the same, right? In other words, if you look in America, you have sometimes the black community or the Hispanic community or other communities voting en masse as a bloc to appoint certain politicians to enact a friendly agenda to them. Now, here's the problem, is that in a state like Israel, there is something, and this is the other side, there's something inherently selfish in doing this. It is an act of, I don't want to use the word that's coming to mind, but it's selling yourself.
Use it. It's fine.
Okay.
It's fine.
It has been accused as an act of political prostitution, okay? Because what you're saying is that, listen, I will give myself away. I will vote. I don't have a conscience when it comes to, I don't know, a healthcare agenda, or combating Iran, or national security, or the economy, or foreign policy, whatever. I want five or six things that benefit me, that is good for me and my friends and my family. And everything
else. These are my core values. Everything else, I don't care. So give me my core values.
Yes, exactly. But the problem is that if every voter voted like that, the whole system would fall apart. In other words, most voters care about things. They have an ideology. They have a laundry list. This is how I think the country should run. Haredim, again, and this is changing a little bit, but historically, Haredim said, I don't care so much how the country is run. I want the things that I like. And the things that I like are a very small corner, and that might not benefit everyone else. It might not be good for the country that Haredim don't serve in Tzal. It might not be good for the country that you spend billions on funding kollels. It might not be good for the country to subsidize housing only for Haredim or subsidize educational opportunities only for Haredim. But because I have the power, I'm going to force the government to do this. And of course, you can imagine this creates tremendous resentment in other sectors of the Israeli population who are saying, one second, why are you only acting in your own favor? Why aren't you taking the broader country into consideration? Why are you only acting for yourselves? You're acting as though you are Jews living in America and voting on behalf of Jews, but you're not. You're part of a Jewish state, and you ought to be voting and ought to be acting in the interest of the entire state, and you are not. And this is the great accusation, and I think with a lot of justification, that is leveled at the Haredim and the Haredi parties, that your interests are myopic, they are parochial, you're acting exclusively in your own interests to the detriment of all the other voters. And I think this has fostered a tremendous amount of anti-Haredi sentiments within the country.
So if you would speak to a Haredi, would they say, no, we're not being... What would a Haredi respond to what you just said now? Like, I'm sure you speak to Haredi all the time, right?
Oh, yeah, cool.
Grow up a little bit in the Haredi?
Yeah, look, I definitely grew up in a Haredi family in London. Now, of course, being Haredim in London, it's different to being Haredim in Israel. And there are subtle and not so subtle differences, political differences, etc. And we were, I would say, more acculturated and broadly educated than most Haredi people, most Haredi families in my family. Having said that, no, undoubtedly, many cousins and friends in Israel who are Haredim themselves, and I live at least partially within that community still. And so there are a few different answers to it. One answer is, too bad, so sad. Okay.
Do they really say that?
Look, they'll say, this is my political priority. And my political
I'm not getting involved in the political side. The spiritual side I'm getting involved with.
Yes, exactly. And they also might turn around and say, listen, politics is a dirty game anyway. Everyone's in it for themselves. Everyone's in it to try and get what they want for themselves. I'm just more honest and open about it. And also, it depends how one defines one community of concern, let's say. In other words, within Israel, many voters, at least certainly from a secular perspective, define their community of concern as the entire country, let's say, or the entire state. Whereas, let's say, Arab voters might not. Arab voters might say, no, actually, my community of concern is much, much more than the state itself, is the Migzar Haravi, sort of the Arab sector. But Haredim might say the same, etc. And of course, they really mean it. They really believe that their primary community to whom they have an obligation to preserve, to perpetuate. And this goes back to a little bit what I'm saying before, is the Haredim still feel, in some ways, like they felt at the beginning of the state and like they felt in the 19th century, as an embattled minority, as an embattled and people surrounded by pernicious forces that are trying to break down their way of life and trying to force them out into the open world. And therefore, they're saying, we are going to be politically active in order to try and forestall this. Now, there's another accusation that, of course, is leveled at the Haredi community because of this, which goes as follows, which is that the Haredim, one of the principal justification for not joining Tzahal is, they say that our Torah learning keeps everyone safe. Okay, our Torah learning is that thing that allows everyone to, allows the rest of the country to basically to function. And therefore, all we need to do is learn and pray, and that helps everyone else. That will solve everything, is our learning and our prayer. The problem is that politically, that's not how Haredim function at all. As I said, they are very politically active. They organize very effectively. They vote en masse. They bring buses of women and young men, and everyone has to go and vote. Everyone has to go and vote on election day in Israel if you're Haredi, because they need every single, they need every single vote. And therefore, there seems to be, again, this is the accusation, level of Haredim, there seems to be something fundamentally disingenuous in saying, on the one hand, no, all I need to do is pray and learn and everything will be okay.
So you're saying if it's really pray and learn, don't even go vote, you're saying?
You can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh, all I need to do is pray and learn and the country will be safe. No missiles will fall on Tel Aviv if that happens, on the one hand. On the other hand, spend an enormous amount of time and effort agitating and organizing for your own political benefit. Because then that alone indicates that you don't really believe exclusively in prayer and exclusively in Torah learning. You believe in prayer, Torah learning, and political action, and turning up on election day, and sitting in the Knesset, and making sure that your community is funded, and making
during
sure
your
that you...
Hishtadlut.
And this is also, again, it breeds tremendous anti-Haredi resentment in the land of Israel to see this apparent double standard. When it comes to when it comes to securing the own hatava, the own benefits within the government, Haredim are very active. When it comes to securing the safety of the entire country, Haredim adopt a fundamentally passive mode and say, oh, all we need is learning and praying. There is this double standard.
How many Haredis are there by the books? Like, how do we count a Haredi? Like, over 18?
Well, once again, I looked a while ago at the statistics. I'm not entirely sure. I think something like a 10%. Of the Israeli population, maybe slightly more. So I think it's slightly under a million Haredim in total, if I recall correctly. Again,
that's not even a lot.
Fact checking. Well, that's the population right now. But here's a nice statistic that I had a couple of years ago, which is that the largest Haredi city is exactly now. See, this is the problem. I should have done my homework all before. One of the very large Haredi cities, I think perhaps Modi'in Elit or one of the others, the average age of the entire city is 8 years old. Okay. That's how many children you have, right? And Haredim are multiplying, are doubling in size almost every 15 years. It's almost an enormous amount. I think the amount of exemptions given out each year in the tens of thousands, I think 40,000, something like that. Now it is getting to the point where it's actually a national security issue for Haredim not to be mitgayus, not to join the army. Because again, there's a very large tens of thousands of potential soldiers not soldiering.
Arutz 12, one of the top TV stations that interviewed some Haredim. Now, I don't know if it's minority, if it's a half of the minority. I don't know if it's a crumb of the percentages of the Haredi world. I don't know, but I'm going to put a clip of the video, and also it's going to be in the show notes. I just want to note it here that we're going to put what you mentioned a few moments ago of the idea that some Haredi, and I don't know how many, believe that by them sitting and learning, that's a protection of the country. And if they protect, that they're in the spiritual tzava, the army for spirituality, and if everybody would leave doing averot and sit and learn Torah, there won't be Hamas and we won't need to fight the nations. I'm going to put that video here. I want to ask you, no, I know it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I know that it's Chazon Acharit HaYamim. I know that we're not living in those days that it could be like that. How many people do you think in the Haredi world really believe that?
So I would say that is the official Haredi party line. And I would say a majority. I'd say 80, Yeah, a lot. No, I would say a large portion of people. Okay, one second. Let me back up and say a couple of things about that. Firstly, what you saw in that video is an extreme form of this claim, because the extreme form of this claim was that these tragedies of October 7th, the outrages of October 7th, only happened to people because they were partying there at a music festival. And I want to put that theology to one side for a moment. It was an extreme version of that. But I think the softer version, that by learning Torah, you are doing at least as much for the country, if not more, than those who are serving in Tzahal, that I think is a very widespread view. And that's definitely said by most Haredim. How much believe it in their true hearts, I don't know. There are a few good reasons to disbelieve it. But before going to why I think it's nonsense, it's very curious, because in a way, it's quite a pro-Zionistic way of thinking. What do I mean by this? I mean that if you'd have gone back several decades and asked Haredim, what excuse do you have for exempting yourself from Am Yisrael learning Torah? They'll say, what do you mean? Learning Torah is the most important thing in the world. There's nothing more important than doing that. And therefore, the rest of the world can go jump in a lake. I don't care if the Zionists are in charge here, or if the Arabs are in charge here, or I don't care if we're under British occupation. Who cares? I want to sit in my yeshiva and learn, and whoever the political power is, the politics be damned, essentially. Whereas now, a much more common claim made by Haredim is, we are contributing to the state. We are the front lines of the state. It's because of us that Israel is succeeding, which in a funny way, it's them arguing that they are doing their bit for the state of Israel. They are soldiers. They are crack frontline troops in the state of Israel. That's a completely different argument. So in a way, it's a funny claim. But to me, that claim shows that many Haredim, much more so than their predecessors, much more so than previous generations, today, in many ways, do identify with the state of Israel. And in fact, you can see this definitely in Chutz La'aretz.
I see what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying? In Chutz La'aretz, definitely, you see an uptick in Haredim supporting the state of Israel, saying nice things about Tzahal, davening, learning, donating, going on mission trips to Israel. This is something much more common within the Haredi community, certainly in the United States and in England. But I would say even within Israel themselves, there is an understanding that, look, Israel is the state that we have. There is all the other alternatives would be disastrous, would be absolutely catastrophic for the Jewish people. And therefore, there has been a softening of the very old, in-principled objection to the existence of the state of Israel. Now, of course, there are some on the extreme, those who belong to the Peleg Yerushalmi, those who belong to the Satmar Chassidut, certainly those in the Neturei Karta group, who many of whom object to the state as such.
Peleg is a...
You're right. I probably shouldn't have lumped it into that. The Peleg is a very strong form of anti-serving...
They'll take all the privileges the Medina gives. Anti-Medina like Satmar.
Okay, let me rephrase this. The narrative is, the narrative was for many decades in the Haredi community, there is something essentially pasul in the state of Israel. There's something essentially illegitimate of it, which is that it's Jewish without being religious, right? In the Haredi mindset, that is enough to damn. For many, to damn the legitimacy of the state of Israel. How can you have an entity that claims to be Jewish and is run not according to halakha, right? This is something for many decades in classic Haredi thought, something that is sufficient enough to say that the state of Israel is evil. That is definitely still held, as I said, by rank and file some Hasidim. There's definitely something still held within the Neturei Karta and among some of the sort of the brisker elements of the yeshiva world, let's say, for lack of a better word, that is a strong core of the very anti-serving in Tzahal elements of the Haredi society, for example, the Peleg Yerushalmi, for whom, again, the whole state of Israel has this rotten core at it. In other words, it's not something worth defending. The argument that I said before, the Haredim are saying, oh, we're learning Torah in order to make the soldiers of Tzahal be more successful, in order to protect the state of Israel, that's a fundamentally pro-Israel way of looking at it. It's saying, no, one second, we're part of the state of Israel, we're pushing our weight, we want Israel to succeed.
You're doing your job, we're doing your job.
We want there to be victory in Gaza, we want there to be safety in Yerushalayim. That's fundamentally pro-Israel. Again, with caveats and with a kind of, it's not fullest form, which is why I think it has spread and has become as popular as it has within certain Haredi world. Now, the problem is that there are, of course, many issues with this point of view. As I said, A, it's not how Haredim work. Haredim don't actually, pragmatically, behave as though they believe the Torah and Tefillah will sort everything out. Actually, for the large part, they, again, one might say to their credit, maybe, They are very politically active, very effective organizers, very efficient in getting what they want from the levers of power, which, again, that's the right of every subgroup within a democracy. It's also the problem with the whole, oh, we're going to learn and that will make everything fine, is historically false, in the sense that there are many sad examples throughout Jewish history where there was plenty of religious people and plenty of learning Torah going on, and that didn't stop massacres and slaughter. There are plenty of religious people in the late 11th century in the Rhineland, and the Crusaders still came in.
And even now, in this war.
And butchered and burned and drowned.
And even in the war.
Yeah, exactly. No, and also in the Holocaust as well, and in 17th century Poland.
I actually don't believe it's the majority. I can't fathom that it's the majority. Maybe it's the narrative that some people feed. I cannot believe that it's majority of the Charedi that they actually think that.
No, I have to say, I firmly disagree with you on this, because this is the only thing. If you think about it, Atana, this is the ultimate thing that can quiet your conscience. Let's say you're a good Haredi person. You're a good person. You want the state of Israel to succeed. Let's say you even like your Chiloni neighbors or your Dati Leumi or Mesorati neighbors. You're basically a good person who wants your country to succeed. You want your people to succeed. You want the Jewish people to be safe and happy and good and everything. But you observe that your own migzar, your own sector of the population, do not go to Tzahal and will resist to the point of physical violence in general. Again, there are some Haredim who do go.
But it's the why. JJ, I'm arguing
But if you're an individual in that population and you know that your population that you identify with don't serve in Tzahal, so you want to cast around for a reason that explains why you do what you do, because you don't want to leave the Haredi world. You're happy being Haredi. You're a married woman with children, or you're a guy, you learn the color. Like, you're happy where you are. So you don't want to leave the Haredi community, but you also don't want to be, you know, a terrible person and turn around and say, oh, I don't really care. Yeah, whatever. The soldiers can win or lose in Gaza. I don't care how many of them get killed. Like, you don't want to say that. That's a terrible thing to say. So what do you say? You say, you parrot the official party line, which is, I'm doing the thing. In fact, I'm helping more than anyone else. That God is watching over the soldiers.
Conscious.
Yes. That's why I think it's a popular narrative. It allows them to believe that doing the right thing allows them
I grew up hearing differently. And I don't know. Again, I come from the Haredi world. I grew up Haredi. My siblings are Haredi. I heard a different narrative. The video that was going around, I literally never heard that in my life. I had to send it to my siblings. And I'm like, and I said, Abba and Ima, do you believe in this? And they're like, Mamash, it's painful to watch. It was painful. And they're about Olam Haredi. But they did say it's nothing to do with who's doing more. We believe that going to the army is again, we're going to break the Olam HaYehudi HaDati and we're going to lose our core values. And the army is not giving us the ability to stick with our core values. So we're not going to go because our being T and to continue the Am HaYehudi with that is important.
So there are two further factors. We've explored until now basically one factor, which is the vestigial hostility the Haredim have had towards the state of Israel, which I argue, and many have argued, that is slowly dissipating. And there are many ways to see that in many ways. But there are two other further arguments. The second argument is the Chilun point of view, the secularization. The idea is that if we send our boys, and certainly our girls, let's say just our boys for the time being, to army units, they will cease being religious and they will, and basically be, having our children resemble our parents is the most important thing. In fact, I once heard someone define a Haredi as that. Haredi is someone who I want my children to look exactly like my parents. Haredim is a mixture, as with all these things, of ideology, but also a sociology. It's a sector of the population that has its positives and negatives, and people who sign up to it both positive and negative. And the truth is, there are many Haredim who have criticisms of the Haredi system and nonetheless remain. This is true with many, in many
sectors. With everybody in life, you choose your heart, so, and you're like, you'll deal.
Let me address the Chilun point, because the funny thing is, I was a religious soldier serving in Sahel 10 years ago. I was August 13th. Yes, and then therefore I served back then. And the following occurs to me. Look, it is the case that people cease being religious in Sahel. But why is this the case?
Why?
It is the case because being in Sahel for many people is the first time they don't have anyone breathing down their neck for religious reasons. Okay? What I mean by that is many of these boys grew up, let's say, Haredi, Dati Leumi, Mesorati, whatever, and they always had someone, a parent, a rav, a mashgiach, a ram, and a yeshiva, someone who's like on top of them, making sure they conform to the religious standards of whatever institution. Keeping in check. When you go to Tzahal, you suddenly discover something extraordinary, which is that nobody cares. Nobody cares what you do. What is important is that you learn how to shoot a gun, that you learn how to run, that you learn how to do the things that you need to do in order to be an effective soldier, or if you're not in Krav, you're not in combat units, so then are you a good, whatever else, whatever other role that you have to play? Are you good at that? That's the only thing that Tzahal, as Tzahal, care about. And suddenly you're in an environment where you're far away from your parents, far away from your teachers, you're far away from anyone who's going to breathe down your neck. Nobody cares what you do on Shabbat. Nobody cares what you do late at night. Do whatever you want. And that is the point that breaks a lot of people whose religious education isn't strong enough to, or religious convictions, isn't strong enough to withstand the temptation of lack of oversight, okay? And this, to me, is so interesting. The Haredim say, if our boys go to Tzahal, they'll all immediately become Chiloni. And I think this is such a sad indictment of the Haredi educational system, that you think if you left your boys alone in an environment without a Rav and without a parent or anything, they will just immediately get say, okay, that's it. I'm smoking cigarettes on Shabbat.
The Tilumi doesn't say that. The Tilumi doesn't feel that. And there's not the same ratio.
No, here's the funny thing. The Dati Lumi are aware of this problem, but it's a threat they're willing to take because they prioritize sending their children to Tzahal.
So they're saying we're going to lose someone. We're going to lose some of our boys to that, but it doesn't mean that we can't send them to the army. It's just as important.
Yeah, exactly. And the truth is, it's the same with sending your child, let's say, out to a job or sending them out to anything else. Like, in the life of a young person, you can effectively hem them in. You can box them in. You can, again, with schools and with teachers and with rabbanim and this and that. At a certain point, they flee the nest. At a certain point, they get out. Now, right. In the Haredi community, they mitigate this by having them marry someone within the community and live near their parents and be under strict control until they have their own kids and basically are part of the furniture, part of the fabric. That's very much part of the Haredi way of living. And the army is a place when, because there's no oversight, they can do what they want. And it's just, to me, it's an incredibly sad thing that Haredi leaders are basically admitting that their education has not equipped their children for maintaining a religious lifestyle within a neutral environment, not even a hostile environment, because Tzahal allows for Shmirat Shabbat. It allows for being a religious Jew. It provides kosher food. It provides time off in the morning to pray. Like, I went into Tzahal religious and came out of Tzahal religious, and so did most of my friends. And like, this is exactly it's not impossible, difficult. It's not impossible.
I think they'll say probably not enough, and maybe you were lucky, and maybe Nachal Haredi or whatever, or maybe it's not majority, and there's a lot of smolanim that hate on the religious. Maybe, I don't know. I can hear them say not very nice that JJ had a nice. I'm playing devil's advocate. I wasn't in the Tzahal, and I didn't send my children to Tzahal. And right. I'm kudos to everybody that did. I'm playing devil's advocate of people that are going to be listening, and they'll say, okay, maybe JJ had a good experience as a dati, and he was strong enough. But I think they're going to say it has nothing to do with our education. It has to do, al tamid et ben adam ben nisayon shehem lo yochlim lamod bo. And Tzahal is a nisayon that no man can come out religious theory.
That's statistically and factually false. In other words, it's not true that everyone will come, or not. There are some people who become irreligious in Tzahal. There are some people who become more religious in Tzahal. I've seen that myself as well. People are exposed to religious people and start being interested in that and then start to keep Shabbat. That also happened. But no, a vast portion of people who go into Tzahal as religious, I don't have exact numbers. I don't know if anyone has exact numbers, but a large portion do come out also religious. And again, it's due to inner conviction and inner drive and inner will. Are you a strong religious person yourself? If you are, then you'll be able to withstand going to Tzahal, and you'll be able to withstand going to university, and you'll be able to withstand going out and getting a job and working as a mechanic or working as a lawyer. You'll be able to do these things because you are strong. Education has equipped you to not fall at the very first hurdle. And to me, whenever I hear a Haredi person say, listen, we send them, they're going to throw away the kippah in the first 5 minutes, I think that's very unfortunate. It's a tragedy that your religious educational system has presupposed that they will remain incarcerated in your community their entire life. They'll never be able to move 1 centimeter to the right or 1 centimeter to the left. Otherwise, they'll fall the first hurdle. And I think that actually a good religious education will equip someone to be religious no matter where they go, no matter what they do. You want to go and be a parachute instructor. You want to be a motorbike mechanic. Do whatever you want. But there's a way to do it in a way that you remain religious. And if you failed to equip your children to do that, then you have failed to equip your children with a real education. And that's, to my mind, a terrific indictment of that community.
So you're trying to, what I'm understanding, you're saying, like, maybe the answer is, let's educate our kids and prepare them more to be able to go out to the world. And maybe some should stay 600, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, whatever. But the ones that are really not Toratam Umanutam, I think we're talking about them. There's so many that Toratam, Lo Umanutam. Let's equip them correctly. And some of them want to go, And they're afraid of losing their connection to their family, to their communities, to be ostracized. And they're trapped. They're like, if I leave and I go to the army, it's a making a statement. And what's going to be with my future?
So you said two very important points there, which I want to confirm and reaffirm. One is that the choice of individual Haredi men not to join the army is often informed by that, often shaped entirely by that. In other words, like the rest of us, they are very susceptible to social pressure, and they're very susceptible to important educational influences or parents or grandparents or this or that. And therefore, they don't want to go because of those reasons. And again, I don't think that's admirable at all, but I understand it. It's how a lot of people reach life decisions based on social pressure or family pressure or peer pressure, one kind or another. And the second important thing that you said is the numbers game. I think this is very important because the Haredi community is growing exponentially all the time. When it comes to the army and when it comes to the economy, we can clearly make the case that 99% can support 1%, right? You can make the case that 95% can support 5% or that 90% can support 10%. It's not clear that 70% can support 30%. And it's not clear that 60% can support 40% or that 50% can, it's definitely impossible that 50% can support 50%. In other words, the more the Haredim grow, the more serious the problem is numerically, and therefore the more urgent it is for a decision to be reached, because the larger they are, the more problematic it is that tens of thousands of young men are abdicating their responsibilities in when it comes to the army and abdicating their responsibilities when it comes to participating in the economy as well and just joining the kollel. So you have this, yeah, the numbers game and the proliferation
and it's of Haredi growing. Which in You're principle saying that Haredi isn't a bad thing, is
but it can lead to serious outcomes.
If there's a Haredi that said, often they say they don't even need us. They have enough. They don't need us. What would
so
you say?
I would say two things. Number one is that it doesn't seem to be true. This isn't coming from the top army chiefs or military experts. A thing that Haredim tell themselves, oh, they don't need us, firstly. But secondly, much more to the case, that's a very bad way to base an individual decision. In other words, what gives you personally, at the end of the day, it's an individual decision. Every citizen, every young man needs to make a decision whether to join the defense forces or not. At the end of the day, it's a personal decision. And what gives you the right to say, oh, there's enough people, so I myself personally are going to opt out of this, right? It doesn't stand up to your basic ethical duty to contribute to something that's necessary for everyone. And this is what comes to a point that I want to make, that I've been very hesitant whether or not to make it. And
make
but
it. I say make it.
It's the most controversial thing I will say, and the most... And I'm sure that your listeners, some of them who listen to this, are going to be furious at me for saying this. And it's worth putting out there. And I'd like to frame it a little bit in what I'm going to say, and then allow me to, then you can come in against it, which is the following, which is that there's a third element to this, which is, and it's a word that I don't use, that I want to use in a very specific way, that I don't mean it in the way that is often meant, which is the word cowardice. Okay, the word cowardice. And let me frame it a little bit by taking a step back and thinking about it historically, which is that for the vast majority of human history, being an adult male meant taking up arms at some point in your life, right? If you're a human being living as part of some tribe or some civilization somewhere or whatever it is, if you are an able-bodied adult male, it is very likely that you, that someone or something or someone would threaten your tribe or your nation or your city or whatever it is. And you as an able-bodied person would have to pick up arms and physically put your life on the line and defend yourself against it. The same in the medieval period, if you're a peasant somewhere and your king decided to invade somewhere, or whatever it is, or your country got invaded, it is very likely that you would have to put your life on the line on behalf of the collective. That was definitionally what it meant to be an adult male for a huge proportion of human history. What has happened in the, I would say, post-World War II era, already in the 19th century, but certainly in the 20th century, is that firstly, all-out wars between large nations became much more rare, especially in the West. War became outlawed, right? There's a huge step forward for humanity is that war became illegal without good justification after World War I. And therefore, you stopped having massive wars. And what you had was several countries with professional armies, which meant that only a very small proportion of adult males actually would put themselves in that position, would have to live the life of a soldier. Because the life of a soldier is very difficult and not desirable at all. Not very good pay, not very good conditions, very dangerous, very arduous, very traumatic. But nowadays, thankfully, in most countries in the West, the United States and the United Kingdom, whatever it is, a vast majority of people don't have to live that life. You can have a small portion of people who do live that life because you do need a standing army of some sort. But actually, the vast majority of people don't. And it's gotten to the point that people alive today, males alive today, or certainly my generation, the millennial generation, if you'd go to most millennial males in throughout the West and say, hey, what do you think of becoming a professional soldier? They'll look at you as if you're mad. What? Right. become a soldier is the worst. That sounds appalling. What do you think? I want to live a life, again, I say, terrible pay, terrible conditions, quite dangerous. Sometimes I might even have to sacrifice my life in some stupid, because some general made a mistake somewhere. That sounds like a terrible idea. I don't want to do that. That's not a thing I want to do. Now, of course, if you're living in the United Kingdom, United States, you have the luxury to do that. If you're living in the state of Israel, you generally don't have the luxury of doing that. The standard is, among the Jews, that everyone participates. Everyone at least potentially puts their life on the line. Of course, many people in Sahel don't work Krav units. They're all trained, by the way, even those who don't work, serve in combat units. They're trained in handling weaponry. And in worst comes to worst, they will stand somewhere when necessary. They do serve in Miluim, etc. But, so it's interesting. So if you're living in Israel, you are palpably aware of the difference between you and pretty much everyone else in the Western world, which is that, and parts of the East as well, which is that you don't have to, which is unlike your colleagues in Berlin or London or Washington, you will have to actually take up arms and you will have to put your life on the line. And it seems to me, and this is where I get back to the cowardice thing, it seems to me that at least a significant portion of Haredi reluctance to serve in Sahel is this. They don't want to live the life of a soldier. It's not a pleasant life. If given the choice between sitting out your early 20s safe in a yeshiva, where you have your needs taken care of and you can live the normal, peaceful life of a regular citizen, versus going to stand on a border somewhere and putting your life in genuine, non-negligible danger and putting a massive target on your back by putting on uniform and picking up a gun and putting yourself as a legitimate target for terrorists, a lot of people just say, I don't want to do that. And again, can I blame someone who says that? Not necessarily. I understand that reaction. I understand the reluctance to live the life of a soldier. I understand the reluctance to put yourself physically in danger and put yourself physically on the line. Having said that, in a country where this is necessary, in a country which is surrounded by endless enemies with endless funding, you would love nothing more than to enact on October the 7th across the whole country, it is the duty of every able-bodied male to sign up and to put themselves at the service of the Medina. And if that service means picking up a gun and standing on a border and endangering your life, then that's what you do. And to not do it is, to my mind, certainly, in many ways, a form of cowardice. And intellectually, I would say morally, in many ways, indefensible. And let me say a final thing on this, which is, it amused me a lot that, so when I signed up to Sahel 10 years ago, this was quite unusual. Firstly, in London, it was pretty unusual for people, not unheard of. There were some who did, but most of my friends' family certainly didn't. And because also, again, from a Haredi family, quite unusual that I did that. And everyone would ask me, hey, well, why do you do that? Why do you say, why do you enlist?
Why? Yeah.
And I always laughed at that question. I always had to say, I always thought that was the most absurd question for the following reason. Because whenever I would describe to other people what I was doing with my life, what I would do, I'd get nods of sympathy. Yeah, oh yeah, you finished high school. Okay, yeah, very good. Well done, well done. Yeah, you went to yeshiva. Excellent, good. You're going to university. Yeah, good. Then a round of applause. Very nice, very nice. Getting married, very good. And I joined Sahel, which to my mind is the most obvious and the most basic duty of anyone who cares about the Jewish community in Israel and anyone who cares about the continued safety and security of the people of Israel. But I did my part. I fulfilled my basic ethical and national duty of standing on a border somewhere and playing a small part in the protection of the Jewish people. And everyone's, why do you do that? I think, what a stupid question. Well, you're applauding me for finishing high school. You're applauding me for learning. You're applauding me for getting married. But this thing, which is the most obvious and the most necessary and perhaps the most meaningful thing that a person can do in their life, the thing that will contribute most to the basic safety and security of the entire Jewish people, and you're asking why I'm doing that? The question is never why I fulfilled my duty. The question is only ever why other people can sleep at night having chosen not to fulfill theirs. That was my take.
Wow.
It still is.
Wow. And I think the why that they were asking you was, why would you put your life on the line if you're not Israeli and you can say, I live in London, I don't have to. Because I live in London, I can give that ticket, I don't even live in Israel. So they're saying, why put your life on the line if you don't have to? That's one thing I want to say.
And I think now, that question betrays fundamental lack of understanding what it means to be part of the Jewish people. If you're asking that question in full seriousness, then you've missed the whole point. You've missed everything.
I honestly think that a lot of people would ask that. But when you were speaking, the entire time I was thinking about Simon Sinek. And Simon Sinek would say, you could do hard things, but it's what fuels you behind it. What's your why? When it comes to Tzionim, when it comes to people that believe, Lamud Be'ad Artzeinu, They believe in Medinat Israel. For them, though, that's their why. There's no question. You need to go to the army because sometimes you're going to lose a limb and you're going to lose a person and you're going to lose a loved one and you're going to lose maybe, you're going to have trauma for life because my why is greater than my fear. And you explained to me through this episode that the why of the Haredi isn't the Medinat Israel. There's not such a why for Medinat Israel. So why should I put my life on the line?
Let me correct you. This is the very important point that I want to correct you. I think what you said was incorrect. It's not Medinat Israel, it's Am Israel. It's the people of Israel.
Right? No, I'm saying their outlook is for Medinat Israel. You're saying, don't stop looking at it as Medinat Israel. The Am Israel, the narrative needs to change.
100%. I would say you could very strongly make a case for signing up, for joining an army, even if you're not a Zionist. Even if you're not a Zionist, even if you don't like the state of Israel. Even if the state of Israel was a bad idea, was a mistake. We should have remained elsewhere and we should have waited for Mashiach, waited in Poland and Russia and United States and thing and whatever. And just that even if you believe that, the mere fact that you have 7 million Jews who are under mortal threat from their enemies, who would love nothing more than to wipe every single one of them off the map. And the defense of this, of the world's largest Jewish community, requires people. It requires people with motivation, with talent, with skills, who will sign up and say, send me to do what I need, what you need me to do. And I will do that for a short amount of time. Doesn't have to be a very long time. I didn't do the full, I did the Hezder thing. I did a year and a half serving in Tzal. Doesn't have to be a very large portion of your life. Doesn't have to be the major thing you do in your life. I wasn't even a very good soldier. I wasn't even a very successful soldier, but I was a soldier. And yeah, that's my, you can just, the mere fact that the Jewish people require defending from mortal enemies and that you ought to be contributing to that, that to me is so basic that I don't need to justify it. Other people need to bend over backwards justifying why they decided not to do it. And listen, as I said before, maybe there are good reasons. There are many good close friends of mine who I think are excellent people in the United States and in England who didn't join up. And they'll say family pressure, they'll say career, they'll say they had a girlfriend. They'll use all sorts of reasons, some legitimate, some not. And again, I don't particularly want to judge individuals. That's not my thing. But for me, the obligation was so clear and so overwhelming that it's just for someone to turn around and say, I can excuse myself from this. I'm doing something else is wild. It's astonishing that people feel the license to do that.
I want to wrap up here a little bit. And I first want to say thank you very much for giving me an education and a little bit of an insight and a lot to think about. Now, I want to say I live in America. I'm a proud Jew. I could say that I don't know what I would feel like if my kids would decide to go to the army. I'm definitely not going to cheer them on, go to the army. I'm going to say that out loud. But it's not for religious reasons. It's from fearful as a mother. If they would go to the army, I would be the proudest mother. Will I probably not sleep at night? Probably. Will I have probably trauma for life? Probably. Will they probably have a lot of things in life? Probably. Will I be very proud? Yes. But it won't. Will I be scared? And will I pray probably more than ever in my life? Probably. Will I tap into my emunah more than ever? Probably. But I want to say that I think what a lot of times people are having a hard time with is that they're doing it in the name of religion. And sometimes the biggest pain is when you say it's in the name of God and agunot in the name of God or in the name of religion. Don't abuse religion. Don't bring God into this. Say, I don't want to go. Say, I don't believe in it. They're not accommodating me. And say it's not fitting to my core value, but to bring God into this? Is this really what God wants? I don't know.
But as I said, this is a post hoc justification for something that they've already arrived at, probably due to peer pressure, probably due maybe to some form of cowardice, maybe to some form of unwillingness to be part of this, or maybe even a vestigial antipathy towards the state of Israel. There are many other sort of pieces to this puzzle. And I think the decision not to sign up is made way in advance. And then when they're pressed, when you said, okay, why haven't you put on uniform? Why haven't you put your own life in danger? The Haredi response to say, oh, we are doing our part. We are, you know, learning things. So that is a justification which quiets their own conscience much more, which is why I think so many believe it, because they have to believe it. Oh, if they didn't believe it, they wouldn't sleep.
It would be painful to exist. But also a lot of them say, we do Zaka, we do Atala, we do Chesed, we do organizations, we do. And they are a member of society, but I think your point is very, very admirable, but we can't compare, like going into Gaza and putting your life on the line and never knowing if you're going to come out. Yeah, every Jew walking around can think that.
Now, let me make a point from the other side, which is, I think it is the duty of the Medinat Israel, the State of Israel, and of Tzahal, to do what they can to accommodate Haredim who do
that's
want to.
That's what I wanted to wrap up on. JJ, as somebody that went to Tzava as a dati, what needs to be done on the side of the, like, you want the Haredim to come, you want to make it for us that we'll tolerate it? What do you think needs to be done on the other side to say, okay, let's accommodate them a little bit or a lot of bit?
Honestly, I'm very hesitant to give very practical recommendations for the simple reason that I right now don't live in the land of Israel. I'm a little bit out of the loop of what is going on the ground right now in Tzahal in terms of Gius Haredis. I don't want to say something which is either being done or cannot be done for other reasons. But I would reiterate that, you know, on the one hand, it is the duty of the vast portion of able-bodied men in the State of Israel, including Haredim, to put themselves at the service of Am Yisrael 100%. Having said that, Tzahal should certainly make it their business. They tried to do a Nachal Haredi. It was a bit of a failed experiment for a variety of reasons. But that was certainly a step in the right direction to constitute units, maybe units similar to Magen David Adam and to Zaka and to Atzal and other such things, maybe units of computer technicians or those who serve in intelligence and other such things, which are very Haredi friendly. Let's say men only and women only or whatever it is, just to make it such that you can accept or receive large numbers of Haredi people who will feel reasonably comfortable in the environment. Now, of course, I don't think Tzahal have to go 100%. They don't have to make the bases look like a yeshiva or look like a seminary. It is an army after all, at the end of the day. But Tzahal can and certainly should make larger and more sincere steps in trying to accommodate the Haredi community. And that's 100% a given. And I will fully accept the point. Exactly how this ought to be done, I'll have to think on that. I think everyone should think on that. But I'm not sure I want to give very concrete recommendations.
Okay, maybe they'll hire you as an advisor if they really want to take it further. But I think this conversation is not for the broad. I think we're talking everybody do a cheshbon nefesh. Really, we're not here to cancel anybody and to say outright, everybody do a cheshbon nefesh and ask yourself, why am I doing this? What are my truths? What are my truths that I believe in? What are my truths that I was programmed to believe in? Do I believe in it? And where am I coming? And how am I showing up? And really, lasot seder in our stories and in our convictions and our statements.
Yes. And I would say this. I would also say that you are the author of your own life trajectory in the sense that there are always excuses or always reasons, let's say, even be more charitable, always reasons to go with the flow and to do what you have always thought about growing up and to take the path of least resistance. There's always a strong temptation towards the path of least resistance. But at the end of the day, you have one life and you will have to justify to yourself the way that you've chosen to live long after your parents are gone, long after your teachers are gone, long after everyone else has disappeared from your life. At the end of the day, you are the only one who can choose how to live your life and also who has to justify to themselves the choices that you made. And this is one of those things. There are several such choices in life where it is difficult for me to understand how people truly quiet their conscience on this. It's difficult, and take stock of your life and live it the way that you think is the correct and admirable way to live, even if there is disapproval from those who are nominally responsible for raising you and educating you.
You recently went to a rally against going to the army, right? You were with Madim. There's a picture of you.
It's a 10-year-old picture. Very briefly, it's a 10-year-old picture.
Oh, it's 10-year-old? I thought it was.
Yeah. This is what I was serving. This is when I was in Madim. Which is that, yes, there was a anti-Gius and anti-serving in Tzahal rally. In fact, a massive one in Jerusalem, hundreds of thousands of people. And I happened to be there. I happened to be in the area and I decided to go, well really for various, primarily because I wanted there to be, on both sides, I wanted there to be someone from Tzahal in the rally in Haredim. And I wanted the people of Haredim to see someone who's proudly served in Tzahal. And I wanted both sides to see that it is possible for someone to stand there and to continue to stand there. And both camps think what they want about that individual. But at the end of the day, those two camps aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. And it is very important for someone who represents both to stand up and say, look at me, it is possible to do and you should do it.
And what happened there?
So for most part, I'd say something funny. I got a lot of different reactions from people. Firstly, in my life in general, I was inundated with messages both from people who thought I was supporting the Haredi side and people who thought I was supporting the Tzahal side. I also got reactions at the time. I was really at the center of the rally. I was 100 yards from the stage. And obviously, I was the only one dressed in green. Everyone else was in black and white. So I'm very noticeable, very visible.
Right.
So some people thought I was there to antagonize and therefore came up to me in a threatening manner, would yell at me, a couple people spat at me or tried to steal my kippah, whatever it is.
Oh my.
Quite a few people came up to me and shook my hand and said, hi.
Wow, that's beautiful.
And you know, that was part of it as well. It was also funny because there was a group of about five or six Sephardi yeshiva bachrim, big guys, who decided to adopt me halfway through the rally and stood around me as a kind of guard of honor and made sure that nobody... But it was very sweet. And they decided to do that. And that was very nice. However, and so most of the rally passed by without particular... Again, it was mostly an hour-long mincha and some saying some tehillim and one or two speeches. There wasn't much there in the rally to get too excited about. It's true that after the rally ended, and I was walking back through Jerusalem, through Givat Shaul towards Har Nof, I was surrounded by a group of Haredi youths who were threatening me and pushing me, and I had to be extracted by a couple of policemen and security guards.
Really?
Yes. It was a very nasty situation. So you could say that I, just by standing there in my uniform, I received, you know, all possible sides of the Haredi ethos, both positive and negative, those who really appreciated what I did and understood that even though they weren't serving themselves, they loved those who did and would offer to help me and those kinds. And there were those who saw me essentially as a traitor, as a backslider, as somebody who's doing something, compromising the values of the community. And therefore, if those policemen and security guards hadn't showed up, I don't know what would have been the end of that altercation after the rally. Wow. But I don't dwell on it too much.
Wow, thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for your duty. And thank you for your passion. And thank you for educating us. And really, you never know where one voice can lead to, what heart or one decision or changing of the minds, or maybe bringing the next Chazonish to a table that can maybe hopefully have a conversation. I always leave my guests with a question. If there was someone in the history from Adam and Eve till today that you can meet, who would that be and what would you ask them?
This is an excellent question. Okay, I'm going to give an answer that you probably haven't heard from other audience members and you're probably... Okay, a huge portion of what we know about ancient Jewish history comes from one man called Josephus. He was a historian in the time of the Romans who was a Jew, grew up in Jerusalem, part of the elite, and he actually fought against the Romans in the Hamerit HaGadon, the great revolt around 70 CE about the destruction of the Second Beit Mikdash. And then he famously went over to the Roman side and wrote various histories and wrote a huge account of Judaism, a history and a sort of anthropology, and basically described the Jews as he had it. Now, here's the problem. Historians, and he is by far the best source that we have of the whole of ancient Judaism, the whole period, because Chazal didn't do much history. Chazal didn't write much history. We weren't interested so much in describing the world around them, etc. And Josephus really put pen to paper and wrote thousands of pages worth of history. Now, here's the problem. We don't know how much to rely on him, okay? Because he himself was writing in a very apologetic vein. He was trying to justify his own actions. He was trying to justify the revolt, but also to justify the Romans who were by then his patrons, who were paying his stipend, etc. And one of the major problems facing Jewish historians now is that we have an enormous mass of historical information by Josephus, but we don't know which parts of it represent, let's say, a true depiction of ancient or Second Temple Judaism and Herod and all the Pharisees and the Sadducees, etc. But we don't know the extent to which Josephus was telling the truth and to what extent he was, let's say, massaging the truth or making things up out of whole cloth just to make himself or the Jews or the Romans or someone look good for whatever reason, for whatever purposes. So I would sit him down for dinner, take out a notebook and say, Mr. Josephus, okay, now time has come to cop up, okay? We want to know what the world of the second, of the Bayit Sheni, of the ancient Jewish world, what it looked like. I want you to sit down and tell me and exactly from what sources it, because I want to know what it looked like, what the past was, and then what was the world in which Hillel and Shammai, Rabbi Akiva, and Bar Kokhba, and those who participated in the revolt, and King Herod, and Hamak, and all these people lived. I want to know what that world truly looked like, and I want to know whether we can rely on him or not, basically. And so this is one of the great mysteries of Jewish history. And so I would corner him and make him confess how much he actually knew and how much he made up, and so we can know what was going on.
I love that answer, because I think it's part of your authenticity. I want to know truth, and I want to know how we evolved to where we are now and what part of it is authentic and what part of it is like massaging, as you say, the truth in order to make it feel like seem good. Wow. Great answer. Great answer. Thank you for your time. We'll put all the links, podcast, for your podcast that you have. We're going to put link in the show notes, and any other links that you have, we're going to put there. And I can ask you so many questions, but I'm going to let you go. And maybe we'll have you on again, because I do think that we need to address also the topic of how do we bridge the gap? Like, now we're all about fighting Hamas. How do we bridge the gap between two of these big parties that are really Am Yisrael? Because if they fall apart, what are we fighting for?
I agree. I couldn't agree more.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Until next time.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Understand. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please hit that follow button on your favorite podcast app. This way you don't miss an episode and you help us grow. You are part of our growth. We appreciate your support and we hope you choose to listen to us on our next episode. We'd love to hear from our audience. If there's anything you would like us to research, to talk about, please contact us on our website, listeningtounderstand.com. And if there's any insight that you got from this and you want to share with others and you are happy for us to read it out loud on our show, send us your insights, send us your thoughts. We want to listen to understand. Bye till next time.